Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
Are you ready for today's lesson?
Yes, sir!
Then listen to your father and repeat after me. I won't grow up.
I won't grow up.
I don't want to go to school.
I don't want to go to school.
Just to learn to be a parrot.
Just to learn to be a parrot.
And recite a silly rule.
And recite a silly rule. If
Peter Pan won't grow up. But the book that captured his story turns 100 this year. All Neverland and Wendy, Brash Boys and Clap Your Hands Flight. And a remarkable story behind the story. This hour on Point, a century of Peter Pan.
I don't want to wear a tie.
I don't want to wear a tie.
Or a serious expression.
Or a serious expression.
In the middle of July.
In the middle of July.
Joining me now in the studio is Maria Tatar, chair of the Folklore and Mythology Department at Harvard University, where she's also professor of Germanic languages and literature. She's author of Enchanted Hunters, The Power of Stories in Childhood. Her big new book, out from Norton for the centennial and jammed with history and backstory, is The Annotated Peter Pan. Maria Tatar, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Wow, it just comes back and it comes back in a hurry and it's like it never went away. Can it really be 100 years? I guess so.
It is. Today is the birthday.
And the birthday you describe here is, I mean, this thing has in J.M. Barrie's hands this long rolling birth. It's not one thunderclap of a birth. He started actually playing with children, turned it into a stage play. The stage play into this. The birthday today, I guess, the first version really published, Peter and Wendy, it was called, and then Peter Pan some years later. But this is the first time what's first about today?
Well, this is the birthday of the novel of Peter Pan and Wendy, as it was called. The play was put on in 1904, but it wasn't written down at that point. Barrie didn't put pen to paper for the play until 1928. And he kept changing the play. He kept changing scenes, rewriting, depending on how the performance went.
He was gigantic at his death, and he lived in an age of big authors. He was the richest author, I think, in the British Empire, which straddled the world.
And prolific, churning out one play after another and completely involved in the production of the plays. That is, going to rehearsals, going to performances, shaping the play through its various stages.
And all of this out of a life story that's so remarkable when you think of Peter Pan. In particular, I mean, here he was born in Scotland. I think it's one of 10 children, something like that. And then the famous death of his brother, the mother's favorite son, when that brother was just 12 years old, the boy who would never grow old, in his case, because he died.
Exactly. We think of Peter Pan as being about fantasy, fairy dust, flying, all of that, Neverland, adventures. But it's also connected with trauma and tragedy. Barrie lost his brother, who it was on the eve of the brother's 14th birthday.
In an ice skating accident.
New ice skates, rough and tumble play, a concussion that turned out to be fatal. And Barrie lost not just his brother, but his mother, who responded. She retreated to her bedroom for an entire year.
He was desperate to bring her out of it. I read somewhere that he dressed in his brother's clothes to try and
soothe
her.
Yeah, he had to actually become an actor. He put his hands in his trouser pockets and whistled the way that his brother once had. And that was the moment, I think, when he became the boy who could not grow up.
A trauma for him as well. I mean, the reports here that he kind of stopped growing himself at that point, maybe even never wholly matured as a man.
He was completely traumatized by the fact that he was short and by the fact that the ladies did.
Something like that.
Well, he was actually 5'2", which in those days.
Yeah, not so short.
But he was always described as being boyish, and he felt that the ladies never paid much attention to him. As a result, he felt that a few more inches would have made him more attractive to the opposite sex.
The dead brother would never grow up. Maybe Barrie, J.M. Barrie himself in some way would never grow up. And out of that, generation after generation of fascination with this story of Peter Pan. Here's Sandy Duncan, the Broadway production, Peter Pan, 1979.
Now, first, I have to blow fairy dust on you. lovely thoughts.
Think lovely thoughts.
Uh-huh.
Think lovely thoughts. Fishing.
Hopscotch candy.
Christmas.
Summer candy.
Flowers.
Candy. Lovelier thoughts, Michael. Christmas.
And up they go over the theater. You can hear the oohs and ahs of the audience there, and of course, right onto the big screen as well. 1953, the animated Disney film, Peter Pan, played by Bobby Driscoll in that case, teaches the darling children how to fly.
All it takes is faith and trust. Oh, and something I forgot. Dust.
Dust?
Dust.
Yuck, just a little bit of pixie dust. Now, think of the happiest things. It's the same as having wings.
Let's all try it just once more.
Look, we're rising off the floor.
June and me.
Oh, my.
We can fly.
You can fly.
We can fly.
And off it goes into cultural history and all this picnics and summer and candy and flowers and pixie dust. And yet, this is anything but just frippery here. There's also sort of murder and mayhem and amoral mischief. Forget about who cares what's right or wrong and all the rest. It's all in Peter Pan, Maria.
Oh, Captain Hook and that clock that is ticking in the crocodile, reminding us that the rest of us are all going to grow up one day and die.
And Peter
Time
Pan, who has
passing.
No commitment to being good, he's willing to be bad as he wants to be.
He is amoral, and he's a figure in the stage directions. Barry wrote, he is never touched by anyone, which is an extraordinary, never physically touched. But I think he understood that that also meant he's never moved by anyone, emotionally moved. And recall, the girls are all running after him, Tiger Lily, Wendy, Tinkerbell. And he is the complete narcissist. So he isn't touched by them. He befriends them. But he wants to be their son more than anything else.
What's the mythological root that Barry is tapping here with Peter Pan? I mean, you've got, interestingly, right in the name Peter, sort of a famously Christian name, Pan, famously pagan
right,
name. But
right.
What's it go back to?
Well, in the screenplay, Peter Pan was riding on a goat. Barry wrote a screenplay in the early 1920s for a silent film.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, he recognized the mythological connections with Pan, this creature of the woods who is totally amoral. The funny thing is we don't pay much attention to his first name, Peter, which doesn't have pagan associations, which has biblical connotations and is connected with a story about faith as well.
J.M. Barrie made up this story, as I understand it, really in play with children, very young boys, and not his own. It's a fascinating story in itself.
Not his own. And I think the interesting thing is that the man who invented the Peter Pan syndrome also cured himself of it. That is, he was, until he was 40 or so, the boy who could not grow up, the man who could not grow up. And then, because of the death of Sylvia Llewellyn Davies and her husband Arthur, both died of cancer within a year of each other.
These were the parents of how many boys? Three, four,
five boys.
Five boys,
yeah,
the Llewellyn Davies boys.
Davies boys.
And he became their sort of playmate before his parents were still around.
That's
they
right.
They died. He actually adopted them, sent some all off to Eton. I don't know all the rest.
He sent them off to be educated. He was extraordinarily generous and took care of them.
And played with them really Peter Pan stories. There's photographic evidence abundant in your annotated version. It brings to mind, though, a kind of Michael Jackson weirdness at some level.
So what
was going on? Was there?
Well, there is not a shred of evidence that there was anything improper in the relationship between Barry and the boys. And the boys themselves write about it. And, you know, Uncle Jimmy was to them avuncular, kind, generous. They sense that there was something slightly odd about him. After all, he had been married to Mary Ansell. The divorce had been very public.
An actress at the time. They never had children of their own.
Beautiful, talented actress who then later told friends that the marriage had never been consummated. So there may have been something asexual about him. He may have been completely repressed, living in the era that, you know, it's a mystery. And in some ways, I think that we have to allow him that secret. That is, sometimes, you know, trying to probe and figure out exactly what his sexual identity was is something that, you know, is beyond what I think the biographers, and I'm not a biographer, should be doing.
We won't push him into a Michael Jackson headline here, but it is fascinating history to look at, and of those boys who became his playmates, the kind of petri dish of the story itself. There aren't, I mean, you can see them having a great time with it in the early 1900s, but then one of them committed suicide earlier in sort of college age, another late in life when he had been called the Peter Pan boy all his life, himself in front of the London Underground.
Peter Llewellyn Davies did in the 1960s. But you have to remember that his life at that point had taken a very bad turn. His wife and children were suffering from terminal illnesses. He did refer to that terrible masterpiece, Peter Pan. And he did feel slightly haunted by the fact that everyone saw him as Peter Pan and sort of expected him to be something that he was not.
Maria Tatar, please stand by. It's great to have you with us. Editor of the big, new, annotated Peter Pan, out for a century of life with Peter Pan. A little more Kathy Rigby here. And I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Chair, duck your head, clear the air. Oh, what lovely fun. Watch me, everyone. Take a look at me and see how easily it's done. I'm
find it with your heart. Never, never land.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about Peter Pan, a century on, Wendy, the Lost Boys, Captain Hook, Tinkerbell, and the origins and durability of the boy who would not grow up.
Never, never land. You'll have a treasure if you stay there, more precious far than gold, for once you have found your way there.
What is the magic of Peter Pan? Do you know the story of his creator, J.M. Barrie, the tragedies, oddities, his friendships with children? And who did you relate to in the Peter Pan story? Why does this story stick around, have such a hold? Maria, I wonder if you could read right from the top of Peter and Wendy, the first novel version of the story.
This is an example of the gift of the perfect opening sentence. All children except one grow up. They soon know that they will grow up, and the way Wendy knew was this. One day when she was 2 years old, she was playing in a garden, and she plucked another flower and ran with it to her mother. I suppose she must have looked rather delightful, for Mrs. Darling put her hand to her heart and cried, "Oh, why can't you remain like this forever?" This was all that passed between them on the subject, but henceforth Wendy knew that she must grow up. You always know after you are two. Two is the beginning of the end.
From the very first paragraph of Peter and Wendy, and there it is, youth and the end in sight, and that's the great divide.
And this awareness, and Barrie himself, who said, "Nothing that happens after we are 12 matters very much. We are grown up and done for." What a frightening
grown up and done,
and done for.
I want to help us understand the cultural moment that this came out of. Here we are just after the famous turn of the century, the Victorian era. Yeah. There had been plenty of miserable lives for children. Why was it? I mean, Dickens, you know, in the Bootblack Factory and all the other stories we've heard on and on and on. Why did Barrie find this the portion of life, the locale of life where one might wish to be forever?
And Barrie himself grew up in a mill town.
So he knew how tough it could be and was for children, child labor,
and
all the rest.
Because it was so tough, there was also a cult of childhood innocence and beauty. And the child was enshrined as the source of salvation for adults in a way. that is a place where you can go back and find the magic. We're still doing that today, try to get back to that lost innocence.
But was it just for, I don't know, the book-buying, you know, affluent of the British Empire in those days, that they had that image of childhood?
Well, I think what happens with Barry is you begin to have the mischievous child, the child who is a little bit rambunctious, who is not sitting still and being obedient all the time. There's sort of a letting loose. And remember, this is the time of the empire, and you have all these boys, books for boys that are reenacting imperialist adventures, tales of shipwreck, of pirates, of sailing the high seas and conquering lands.
Derring do.
Yeah,
Robert
yeah.
Louis Stevenson, of course, was out there with
Treasure Island,
and
yes,
you can feel that in Neverland and Pirates and all the rest.
Barry was a huge fan of Stevenson. They never met, but Barry had planned a journey to Samoa to visit Stevenson.
Wow.
Stevenson died before Barry managed to get there.
What about Huck Finn? I can feel a little bit of that. And maybe there's
huge,
a bit of every.
Absolutely.
Did he know Twain? Did he read Twain?
Yes, and Twain was aware of Barry, too. Barry traveled to the United States a couple of times. And they did correspond. And, it was Twain who called Peter Pan the great uplifting spirit of our age, of our sordid, money-driven age. Quite something.
Thank you, Peter Pan, for heading out that window and away from all that. And Alice in Wonderland and Lewis Carroll and all the rest with the sort of phantasmagorical adventures that they could have in fantasy.
Right. But with Barry, of course, we have the cult of the boy rather than of the little girl. And it's fascinating to me that both Carroll and Barry use their cameras to freeze children,
they
to
actually
stop
did take
time.
Photographs,
they
look
took
at that.
Photographs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in 1856, mm-hmm. Lewis Carroll was taking pictures of little girls. This was at a time when hardly anyone had a camera. And I think there was a kind of need to keep children forever young, to keep them
every family does this now. You know, they fill in the old days, the albums, or today, the online photo album with images so that you can remember forever how they were. But that was a new thing then.
Yes, absolutely. And there's a certain point, oddly, we know this is the secret of parents, that we stop taking photographs, or we're not so eager to reach for the camera when children become adolescents.
Why was Peter Pan always conveyed as this kind of, I don't know, he's dressed sort of like Robin Hood, at least in many. He's got that sort of hat like Robin Hood and the green leggings and all the rest. What was that about?
Well, I think he's the connection with nature, with the figure of Pan, the mythological Pan, who is a creature of nature, of the wooded lands. And oddly, though, Peter Pan did not always wear green. In performances, early performances, he had tan clothes, russet-colored clothes, a touch of red, or sometimes a red tunic. So it was Disney and Mary Martin who really turned him green. It's not clear exactly what colors Mary Martin used.
Yeah.
They're sort of a light green.
I mean, you can go back and find so many. You've got photos of Haley Mills and all the rest. Everybody,
yeah. you know. Could do a whole analysis of how Peter Pan is, how the costume is reinvented.
And always with wires attached and flying through the theater.
And the dangers of flying in the theater. Mary Martin has wonderful stories about crashing into walls.
Spider-Man. Peter Pan had his own hijinks there. Here's a little bit from the 2003 film Peter Pan. This is Wendy, played by Rachel Hurd Wood. Unnerves Peter Pan, played by Jeremy Sumpter, when she, Wendy, talks about love.
Why do you spoil everything? We have fun, don't we? I taught you to fight and to fly. What more could there be?
There is so much more.
What? What else is there?
I don't know. I think it becomes clearer when you grow up.
Well, I will not grow up. You cannot make me. I'll banish you like Tinkerbell.
I will not be banished.
Go home. Go home and grow up.
Go home and grow up, Peter Pan says to Wendy, and off she goes. He just won't be civilized. Was Barry celebrating that? What exactly was he holding up there?
I think that there's a way in which Wendy wants to stay in Neverland, to be part of this world of adventures, to be the mother and to tell stories. But she's drawn back to civilization, to linear time, rather than this eternal return of the same in Neverland, to the flow of generations. The real divide is Wendy wants to be a mother. She wants to be a mother even in Neverland. And, of course, that's the one place where she cannot do that.
Absolutely. But even there, there's this weird kind of tension because the boys want to be just wild as they want to be. On the other hand, Barry has them nestled up around Wendy. Here's a little bit from the Disney film where she's telling them what a mother is. They have no idea.
I'll tell you what a mother is.
Yeah, tell us.
Please, Wendy.
Well, a mother, a real mother, is the most wonderful person in the world. She's the angel voice that bids you good night, kisses your cheek, whispers, sleep tight.
Ah, the sweetest young mother. But wasn't Barry himself kind of conflicted in some versions? Didn't he kill off the darling mother? She was always ill.
Oh,
right?
at the end of Peter and Wendy, he tells us, I despise her. He
Mrs.
can't
Darling.
Decide, Mrs. Darling. Mm-hmm. But he originally had thought about calling the play The Boy Who Hated Mothers. So this deep ambivalence. Here is Barry, who had also written a biography of his mother called Margaret Ogilvy. Mm-hmm. Who writes a biography? Now, Margaret Ogilvy...
And was close to her. You've got photos of them having tea and looking quite comfy.
Very close. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So within the book, you see this deep ambivalence.
What is that about? Is that another Victorian thread?
Well, I think it's really Barry's own peculiar pathology in many ways. I'm not sure how much. Certainly, we can attribute some of it to the culture. But I think it had to do with the family circumstances, with the way that he had rescued his mother. And his mother was also the figure who introduced him to storytelling, who let his imagination run wild, who read with him, who encouraged him to write. So there was always this deep bond. And Barry told friends that his mother figured in every play that he ever wrote, including, of course, Peter Pan.
Ellen is calling from Bethel, Connecticut. Hi, Ellen. Thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Oh, a pleasure. It's such a wonderful memory. When I was a little girl in the early 30s, I had a new edition of Peter Pan and I guess some other stories. The illustrator was a famous woman of the time, Margaret Parent, and one of the pictures was of the statue of Peter Pan in Kensington Gardens in the middle of London.
Mm-hmm.
And in her picture, which I got a reproduction of to post by my bed, there were circle of fairies circling Peter's head, and two small children with very elaborate outfits with fur collars, you know, upscale, gazing up at the statue with wonder.
Mm-hmm.
And it had a kind of magic for me. If I had a bad day, I could take an extra minute and look at that picture, and I would be able to sleep.
Ellen, that's terrific, and you've got a fellow traveler right here with me in the studio. Maria's stumbled or came upon this statue.
It's such a wonderful story, because when I was in London, of course I went to Kensington Gardens. I had no idea where the statue was.
Barry had it set there.
Yes, it was announced in the paper that Frampton and he had a gift for the children in London. But I didn't know where the statue was, and I relied on tourists from all over the world to guide me there.
As they sort of flowed toward it, speaking of it.
They flowed toward it, and before I saw the statue, I heard them say in a chorus, this magnificent chorus, Peter Pan. And, you know, I had this feeling we were on a pilgrimage.
Whether they're from Mongolia or wherever, they're on their way.
So I love the fact that you didn't even have to see the statue. It was just the Margaret Torrent's wonderful illustration that brought it to life for you.
Ellen, thanks for that call. What is it about this figure? I mean, Pan's been around forever. We have that notion. But Pan hasn't always been talked and thought about by everybody around the world, and movies made again. What is it about the if this representation in J.M. Barrie's work, you think, that has made it so compelling that it grabs generation after generation right around the world, what is it about this telling?
I think part of it is that for children, it enables them to suddenly get out. To get out of childhood, to be above it all, to fly away, to be untethered
from
the adult
world. They clap their hands, fly out the window over London and off
into... They get to go to their... Make-believe becomes real in Neverland. And for adults, when we can go back, we have this wonderful opportunity to go back by reading the story and by watching children see the play, read the story, or just look at that picture of the statue in Kensington Gardens.
It was unusual to have this sort of open membrane between adulthood and childhood. Adult readers and child readers both could go there.
Yeah. It produces a contact zone for both of us, and that is the real magic of the story, I think.
Jack in Salem, Massachusetts. Thanks for calling. Jack, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm in my mid-20s now, but when I was very little, maybe 2, 3, 4, going into being 5 years old, I really thought I was Peter Pan. It was just the most magical story in the world for me. My little brother thought he was Captain Hook.
Where did you two get those ideas, I wonder?
We watched the movies pretty religiously, pretty much any movie we could get our hands on of Peter Pan. I wore my Peter Pan costume to preschool most days, as far as I know. I tried wearing it to the first day of kindergarten, but I was sent home to put real clothes on.
Do you remember what it was most about this character that made you want to be this character?
I think he was just the most free and exciting, always excited person. I mean, he kind of embodies that little boyish glee that I know I had, and I identified right with that. And I'm listening to this program. I've got such a huge smile on my face, even though we're, of course, discussing it in a much more adult way than I ever thought about it. That's all I really have to say.
Not too completely adult, we hope. We'll try and hang on to a little bit of that. We'll also look at what that sort of Peter Pan syndrome means. I mean, there's boys who want to be it. And then, Jack, thanks for your call. Maria, there's famously conversation of men or anybody who never does want to leave it, never does. The sort of Peter Pan syndrome, who never let go.
And men who won't commit, as Dan Kiley tells us in the Peter Pan syndrome. We do have this phenomenon of, and I don't think our caller suffers from it.
I think he recognizes the
youth, the energy, the joy. Peter says, I'm youth, I'm joy. But there are kidults and adult adolescents who refuse to grow up. And then the advertising industry has this acronym, KGOY, Kids Growing Older, Younger, which is the opposite phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
So we
old
have
old beyond their years.
Yeah. So there's an interesting age compression going on in our culture, which, of course, makes that contact zone easier. But at the same time, I think we shouldn't forget that when Peter and Captain Hook meet, Peter calls Hook a dark and sinister man. Mm-hmm. He belongs to the grown-ups. And Hook calls Pan proud and insolent youth. So it's a book that also recognizes the divide, that divide does exist.
And it's not all fairy dust on either side.
Exactly.
How terrific to have you with us. Maria Tartar, editor of the annotated Peter Pan. It's out for the 100th anniversary of Peter and Wendy. Here's Uggawug with Mary Martin and Sandra Lee, 1954.
Shh. Uggawug, 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 wah. Shh. If the pirates get you and you're took away by Captain Hook.
Hook!
What'll we do?
I'll just send for Tiger Lily.
I'll just send for Peter Pan.
We'll be coming willy nilly, lily. Send up a flare, and I'll be there. You know you really got a friend. We'll be true love brothers to the end.
Who's the swiniest swine in the world?
Captain Hook! Captain Hook!
Who's the dirtiest dog in this wonderful world?
Captain Hook! Captain Hook!
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Peter Pan, A Century On. There's Cyril Richard, 1954 production of Peter Pan as Captain Hook in Captain Hook's Waltz. It has had every kind of presentation, and now, 100 years since 1911, when Peter and Wendy first came out, the novel form of what had been a stage play, and before that, simply play, in a way, story of Peter Pan. Maria Tatar is with me, chief of folklore and mythology program at Harvard University. She's editor of the new The Annotated Peter Pan, out with all kinds of photos, literally photographs from back in the day. J.M. Barrie, the author, took himself of the boys who were kind of his crew to put this story together and right on through in the many manifestations. Maria, I wish you'd give us just a little bit of a reading about Neverland and how each child in this story had his own version of it in his mind's eye.
Of course, the Neverlands vary a good deal. John's, for instance, had a lagoon with flamingos flying over at it, which John was shooting, while Michael, who was very small, had a flamingo with lagoons flying over it. John lived in a boat turned upside down on the sands, Michael in a wigwam, Wendy in a house of leaves deftly sewn together. John had no friends. Michael had friends at night. Wendy had a pet wolf, forsaken by its parents. But on the whole, the Neverlands have a family resemblance, and if they stood still in a row, you could say of them that they have each other's nose, and so forth. On these magic shores, children at play are forever beaching their coracles. We, too, have been there. We can still hear the sound of the surf, though we shall land no more.
Children at play, each with their own version of Neverland. How did it become Never Neverland and Never 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 Neverland?
Yes, it started as Never 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 Neverland, and Barrie kept reducing it. The term probably originally goes back to the Australian outback, but you know, Barrie.
There was a slang word for the outback, Neverland.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah,
where anything wild and weird and wonderful could happen, maybe.
That must have been it—a place of adventures. And you can see from this description of Neverland that it's really the child's imagination, and I love the fact that there are all these counterfactuals in it. That is, what if the lagoon was flying over the flamingo? Everything becomes
right. No
surreal.
Turn it upside down
and
backwards.
I love the use of nonsense, which is what Lewis Carroll used so brilliantly in Alice in Wonderland. Barrie really understood the child's mind in an unprecedented way.
Here's a little bit from the 2004 film Finding Neverland. Johnny Depp plays Peter Pan creator J.M. Barrie, who asks a young boy, played by Freddie Highmore, to imagine a dog is really a dancing bear.
Because it's absurd. It's just a dog.
Just a dog?
Yeah.
Just? Porthos, don't listen to him. Porthos dreams of being a bear, and you want to dash those dreams by saying he's just a dog? What a horrible candle-snuffing word. That's like saying he can't climb that mountain, he's just a man. Well, that's not a diamond. It's just a rock. Just.
Johnny Depp as J.M. Barrie, author of Peter Pan. I mean, the plays that he put on, you convey how they didn't even have a script at something. They just kind of put them on, they change every time. We picture a kind of man-child living himself in this fantasy world in a way that sounds a bit Victorian in itself. Was there some permission for that in that culture at that time, or what?
I think there was. There was more play acting and improvisation, certainly. And Barrie tells us very early on, literature was my life. That is, creating fictions. Life was a performance, in a sense, and you were always putting on plays and creating drama and melodrama.
And we have to picture this long before videos and DVDs and YouTube pouring
Absolutely.
Out of every digital
pot. Yeah. Where this was a wonderful outlet for play and for entertainment.
Do you have a sense that people were more permitted then to inhabit that realm? Because it wasn't just for sale, you know, at every .com or Netflix.
Oh, yes, absolutely. To take on roles, to find ways to use the imagination to distract themselves. And Barry just did that supremely well. This was the golden age of theater. New means of transportation that allowed people to come into London and see plays and then go home and reenact them.
And as you say, with that whole kind of derring-do stories of the British Empire, which was then near its height, listeners online here, Michigan JF says, you know, he seems to have known nearly every significant late 19th century English author, J.M. Barrie. What a life, spanning the most golden years of England's imperial century. I can feel a kind of nostalgia. It's right there in Disney World. You fly out across Big Ben and all the rest, all the evidence of that power and glory at the time. Sean writes on Facebook, the older I get, the more I envy the boys who won't grow up. When I was younger, the flying looked like fun, but anyone can fly in a plane. I want to stay, Sean writes, a boy forever. Susan in Lexington, Kentucky is calling. Hi, Susan. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm 69 years old, and when I was about 8 years old, I think, I read the book Peter Pan, and I was so sure that Peter was going to come and take me to be his new mother. I used to open my window every night when I went to bed for him to come get me, and when I'd wake up in the morning, my mother would have closed the window during the night.
Now that's
interesting. I'd be so upset.
Yes, and was it because you wanted to fly with Tinkerbell and the rest, or because you wanted to be Peter Pan's mother, or both?
I think I didn't have necessarily a real happy childhood, so I think I wanted an escape from that, but I also wanted to never grow up. And it seemed so much fun. I would sew on his buttons, and I'd tuck him into bed at night. You know, things that little girls like to do at that time.
And with the window wide open and your mother at some point pulling it closed. Susan, thank you for that memory from long ago childhood. I appreciate it. Anne in Arlington, Massachusetts. Anne, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wondered if your guests could comment on gender identity in Peter Pan.
Mm-hmm.
So I grew up in the 60s, so it was Mary Martin and the Disney movie. And I couldn't quite locate myself in that story because Peter was a boy, yet he was played by a grown woman
right. On
stage. And then there's Wendy, who became a mother instantly. So as a little girl, I couldn't figure out where I stood in Peter Pan.
Boy equals woman, girl equals mother. What is going on there, Maria?
Well, that's a great point. There's a lot of gender trouble in Neverland, and you've identified some of the hot spots there. I remember watching the Mary Martin version, the musical, and being very upset by the fact that Mary Martin looks so much like a grown woman to me. She didn't look to me like a boy at all. And now I look at her and she seems quite youthful.
But what was up with that? Why were they casting in that way again and again?
From the beginning, it was only in 1910 that a boy, a young man, played Peter Pan. So there has been this theatrical tradition established very early on with Nina Boucicault others.
Because the idea that this is what a boy man would look like, a kind of feminine version of...
Well, it had also to do with the fact that for a role like that, you needed
an
adult.
Right.
And
we'll show up for
men
the
looked a little bit too much like men rather than boys.
Yep.
So there was a practical reason for it.
Let's hear just a little bit of Boy Man. In this case, this was the Disney version where it is Bobby Driscoll again pretending with Wendy here in the 1953 film that he is an Indian chief.
Big chief greets little mother.
Oh.
Ugh.
Oh, Wendy, is that all you have to say? Everyone else thinks I'm wonderful.
Especially Tiger Lily.
Tiger Lily?
John? Michael? Take off that war paint and get ready for bed.
Bed?
Boys, we're going home in the morning, and...
Oh, Wendy, we don't want to go home.
No go home. Stay many moons. Have heap big time.
Now, Peter, let's stop pretending and be practical.
Chief Flying Eagle has spoken.
Little child voices and all kinds of big issues flying around. Mary in Beaufort, South Carolina, thanks for calling. You're on the air, Mary.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This is exciting. I love Peter Pan. I am 68 years old. I remember almost word for word, not only the book, but of course the movies.
And,
but I've been married 45 years, have three kids, and 8 grand girls, and but I wanted to be Peter Pan.
Yeah, you wanted to be the.
I didn't want to be Wendy.
Why? Because he got to be the brash child who did whatever he liked.
Oh yeah, that probably would have described me fairly well, but I don't know. It was just so liberating. I wanted to fly. I too left my window open every night so they could come and get me, and I just loved it. I don't really know why. I had an aunt who told me if I kissed my elbow, I could turn into a boy. And I just nearly broke my arm trying to kiss my elbow, which was impossible.
Mary, it's a great story, and I appreciate your sharing that. What about the reception and the roles over the years, over a century here, Maria? I mean, were little 1912 girls putting on Peter Pan costumes? Was it all interchangeable all the time?
Oh, well, there were many girls who wrote to the actresses who played Peter Pan, telling them how much they wanted not just the visit, but how they wanted to be Peter Pan, join him in the adventures in Neverland, and not be Wendy. So there's lots of, I think that cross-identification is so easy for younger children. It's sort of like the Harry Potter phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And there we have the boy who lived, not the boy who would not grow up, the boy who lived. And I'm reminded of all the children today who, you know, leave their windows open hoping that they'll get an invitation to go to Hogwarts.
Yeah, it may just be a Hedwig owl at the window. Susan in Montreal, Canada. Susan, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
My reaction actually was different from most of your callers. When I was a child, I found the book very frightening. I found the movie very frightening. And I remember my mother took me to the movie and dropped me off. I must have been 5. And I was so petrified that I wanted to leave, but I was too frightened to move. Because in my mind, the only way that children wouldn't grow up is that they would have to die as children.
Oh, dear.
And the flying was flying to heaven, and I just found the entire story just frightening beyond belief.
Maybe you were at some level sensing the death of Barry's brother behind the story somewhere. What do you say? Thank you, Susan. I'm sorry it was so scary. Well, 5 years old and dropped off at the theater. It is a scary story.
I mean, that reminds me that, you know, for young children, it should be a contact zone. And this is not a story.
A contact zone, meaning?
Yeah, there should be an adult there.
Yeah.
You shouldn't leave a 5-year-old alone with Peter Pan. He is dangerous.
right.
And, you know, for the older child, it's quite different. But, yes, absolutely, Captain Hook could be frightening. The crocodile flying.
Even the Mermaid's Lagoon, it's rising, rising. You can't get off the rock.
And one of the mermaids tries to pull Wendy into the water.
Yeah.
So this is not sugar-coated or anything. There's beauty and there's also horror in there.
Susan, we're glad you survived. Thanks for calling Megan in Monroe, Connecticut. Megan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm 23, and I have been nannying for a 3.5-year-old, and I always wanted to be Peter Pan when I was little, and I told her the story recently, thinking, you know, she's going to love Neverland, and her reaction was, but everyone grows up. We have to grow up. I don't understand. And I thought that was fascinating, because I was like, when I was little, that's all I wanted to do was go to Neverland, and I know you had mentioned earlier in the show about kids growing up more quickly in this generation, and I thought that was interesting.
So you had a 3-year-old ward you're babysitting, and she's saying, get real, Peter Pan.
Exactly.
Wow, I wish she wasn't maybe quite, but Megan, thank you. I don't know, Maria, is that jumping the shark as a child here? I mean, let's not get ahead of that realization.
No, I've talked to many people about their reactions, and there is a divide. There are some people who just, they want to grow up, and the idea of not growing up is horrifying to them. And then as a child, I felt, you know, 9.5 was just great. I did not want to go into double digits at all.
Does Peter Pan go on for another century? We all have a kind of cultural vestigial memory of that realm and the darlings in that London that everybody sees if they go to Disneyland or Disney World. It still lives, you know, in the literature that we know. Now, Pan lived forever, but does Peter Pan go on forever, or does he fade as one day the British Empire and all of that kind of stuff fades?
Oh, yes. Well, and because there is gender trouble in Neverland, and because the book is not politically correct in many ways, I think it is important to keep reinventing him. The amazing thing is that Peter Pan started as a play and a bedtime story, but it's really become a cultural myth. And now we have so many different Peter Pans circulating in our culture. And, you know, I'm so glad of that because there shouldn't be just Barry's Peter Pan.
So Rumpelstiltskin and on and on. I mean, he's just one of those forever things,
he's
maybe.
He's one of those. He has become a part of our cultural imaginary on a global scale. Everyone knows Peter Pan. And we should start, you know, just like the fairy tales that we reinvent, we should also, you know, change his story in ways that work for us.
Oddly, maybe not so oddly, but for all the, high danger and arrows through the heart and all the rest, there's still a kind of, balance here. You've written recently of enchantment and danger in Peter Pan. It's not the really bleak sort of dystopia that some new children's fiction has.
Right. Well, children are curious. They want to know about the world. They want to know about danger. They want to know about growing up. They know what death is. They've heard the word. And so being able to explore the great existential mysteries in a book is an important thing for a child. And everything is disguised in symbolic form, but it is all there. And Barry pulls no punches. Which is why, again, you know, it might not suit every 5-year-old.
I found a kind of icon for courage in that boy who would put his hands on his hips and crow at the world and just would not be cowed by it. I loved it.
That's right. Is afraid of nothing. Even death is nothing but the next great adventure.
A child can use an image of that. Maria Tatar's editor of the big new For the Centennial, the annotated Peter Pan, the story and a beautiful treasury of photographs and images. Maria Tatar, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for inviting me.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. Here's Mary Martin, 1954, I've Got to Crow. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
I just couldn't keep it inside if I tried so naturally. When I discover the cleverness of a remarkable me, how can I hide it when deep down inside it just tickles me so that I gotta let go and crawl. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.